Welcome into the best in paranormal programming. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Tim Dennis. I'm excited today, folks, more than my regular excitement, but let's just call it super excited today, as we have an esteemed guest with us today, one that I've been looking forward to for quite some time. Timothy Hogan is with us today. He's an author and international lecturer who specializes in cross-cultural symbolism. He's also a past master with several different spiritual and initiatic traditions. It includes many bodies, including Freemasonry and Rosicrucian lineages. He is the current Grandmaster for the Order of the Temple of Secret Initiates, which is a Knights Templar lineage. He also runs the Templar Collegia and is associated with it. Timothy Hogan has lectured all over the world in both public and private venues. As a matter of fact, if you go to disclosurefest.org, you'll be able to get tickets to Stairway to the Stars, which is coming up at the Luxor in Las Vegas, November 10th through the 12th. You'll be able to see him lecture there on one of the topics we'll be talking about today, which is alchemy. And I guarantee you, folks, if you go to his YouTube page as well, you'll see a couple of talks that are absolutely fascinating there. We'll talk more about his YouTube page as well as we get into our hour here today. Timothy Hogan is extremely, extremely fascinating. He's a fascinating guy. He's appeared, you've seen him on numerous TV and podcast programs as well. He has lectured at several universities and U.S. embassies as well. Yes, I said U.S. embassies. He has done track to diplomacy in many countries. I'm stumbling because he just got back from Egypt, folks. You would not believe the amount of countries he's been to. We'll talk a little bit about that as well. He's the author of The Alchemical Keys to Masonic Ritual, The 32 Secret Paths of Solomon, Revelation of the Holy Grail, written under the pen name of Chevalier Emeris, Entering the Chain of Union, Novo Clavis Esoterica, The Way of the Templar, Thoughts from Meditations and Elements of the Elements, which we're going to talk about alchemy. That's the book that comes from, and numerous periodicals. Ladies and gentlemen, let's not stall any further. Let's bring him in. This is Timothy Hogan. Good evening, sir.
Hey, good evening. Thanks for having me on your show.
Well, thank you so much for being on. I greatly appreciate you coming onto the program. Like I said, yeah. I've been waiting for quite some time, and you might be able to tell there's a couple of nerves there too. Which I don't get. I don't get nerves. I've been doing this thing for over 30 years, Timothy. So I appreciate it so much that you're on. I got to tell you, I find in having my audience knows that, of course, my 17th great grandfather is Bernard de Tromelay, who was the fourth Grandmaster of the Knights Templar.
Yes.
So to be able to talk to somebody of your rank in the Templar is to me a great honor, and I greatly appreciate you coming onto the program, being able to, to be able to talk with you and speak with you. So we'll get into a little bit the connection between alchemy and the Templar here as we begin to talk. But first, I want to start slow. I want to talk a little bit about alchemy and what alchemy is and what it means, because the average person, I think, hears alchemy, science, and they click that off in their brain because they think this is going to hurt, and we're going to do this so it doesn't hurt.
No, we'll make it very easy.
Yeah. What is alchemy, Timothy?
So alchemy is the precursor to chemistry. In fact, chemistry got its name from alchemistry, which was the name of alchemy. And it was an ancient science. The thing that separated alchemy from chemistry really was that for the alchemist, God was always a part of the equation. It was believed that everything that we're experiencing right now is taking place within the consciousness of the Creator.
So, boy, that'll hit you right between the scientific eyes if you're a current scientist, wouldn't it?
Correct. Yeah, exactly. So the belief was, as far as alchemy goes, is like, look, this is all happening within the mind of the Creator. And just as our thoughts can change, so can matter itself change, because it's all crystallized thought, really. And that we are a subset of consciousness, of that greater consciousness, but we have the ability to access it for ourselves, and to manipulate it to a certain degree. And this was really the basis of alchemy. And you know, it may sound kind of like, I don't know, out there a little bit, but if we remember, like, even in the 20th century, the greatest physicists, you know, people like, well, you name them, Maxwell Planck, I'm drawing a blank at the moment, but all the great physicists of the 20th century, mm-hmm. they also said that they believed that the more they looked at the state of matter and on a subatomic level, the more they came to realize that it operates like a giant mind. In fact, they even had quotes about this, you know, several quotes where they talked about, you know, there seemed to be an intelligence or a mind, that the energy that's behind matter is actually mind stuff. This is what they said. And this became the basis for quantum physicists.
Yeah.
And it became the basis of superstring theory. Everything that we're starting to look at now was based on this concept, but this may seem like, wow, kind of far out spiritual to the modern scientist, but it's an old concept, and it goes back to alchemy. And the alchemists believed this, that we are living in a minefield and of conscious intelligence, and that it manifests in patterns in nature. And if you understand those patterns, you can build stable systems that are in harmony with those patterns. And you can also break down matter, take it apart, and recombine it into new forms. In fact, Sir Isaac Newton, who was 85% of everything Isaac Newton ever wrote on, was actually on alchemy. Most people don't know that. They think about his studies in gravity or mm-hmm. his studies in optics, but they don't understand that behind all that was his studies of alchemy. And most of what he wrote on was alchemy. And Isaac Newton said that the transmutation of light into bodies and bodies into light seems very comfortable in the course of nature, which seems to delighteth in transmutations. I mean, this was the basis of what he was doing. He said, look, it's all light. It's all conscious light. It crystallizes and it turns into forms that we call matter. But that matter could be broken back down again, back into light, and can be rearranged and transmuted into new forms. And this was the basis of everything he was focusing on, you know, with his studies. So that's alchemy. I mean, that's essentially alchemy. I mean, the alchemists of the 1500s and 1600s, they all said, hey, this is an ancient science. It's something that goes back to ancient Egypt. Mm-hmm. It was something that was understood by many of the Greek philosophers, and there were aspects of it that were tied into the Eleusinian mysteries, and that there is evidence of this science being practiced, you know, in the ancient world and in Egypt in particular. And in fact, the word alchemy comes from alchem or alchemet, which was the ancient name for Egypt. So it was the science of Egypt, of ancient Egypt, that was being passed down, studied by different cultures, and, you know, eventually got new life during the Renaissance in Europe. So, but there was alchemical practices being done all over the world. I mean, you know, it's a mistake to think that it's just a European science. I mean, it was all over the ancient world. There were ancient China, ancient India, ancient Greece, ancient Rome, and even in the Americas, they were practicing different forms of this alchemy. Ancient Sumer. In fact, the name of the grail, the or I'm sorry, the name of the alchemical science in ancient Sumer was Graal, Graal, which is, in fact, the origin of the Holy Grail.
Yeah.
Mythos. It was tied in directly to this ancient science. So that's a summary.
Yeah, no, that's great. And we're going to talk a little bit about that. I have a couple of questions for you before we launch into some of these mysteries, because you have some amazing information here, Timothy. I can't tell you. I got into that rabbit hole before we got together tonight and started to, and you can, folks, go to Timothy's YouTube page. It's very easy to find. And we'll have a link to it in the description of this program. We'll make it even easier for you to find. So you can find Timothy's YouTube page and get some of this information. But one of the questions I want to ask you here, and this is, it's simply this. When you say the word alchemy to some people these days who think of themselves as being up to date on scientific progress, I'll put it that way, some of the newer scientific theories, they kind of roll their eyes a little bit and go, nah, that's old information. Nah, it's old stuff. That's the old ways. And they think they know. They think they're in the know, and they kind of poo-poo it. They throw it to the side.
Yeah.
Why is it, and when you learn about some of these incredibly informational and incredibly wonderful things that were discovered back then, why do you think that some of these people who think they're in the know would discount some of these things, especially some of the things that we'll talk about today? Why would you throw this stuff aside and go? Because, you know, if you don't know where you've been, you don't know where you're going.
Yeah.
And why do you think they would throw away the old ways, especially since when you think about it, those pyramids had to get built. And I'm with you on this. I truly do believe they were built by human hands. Why do you think they throw that old information away?
Well, a lot of it's conditioning. You know, I mean, there are periods of time where, for example, one of the points I like to talk about is one of the fundamental aspects of the alchemical science that was understood and talked about regularly in alchemical texts in the 1300s to the 16th, well, really through the 1800s, was there was an element, a fifth element, that was called ether, or sometimes called quintessence. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there were some scientists who, and I'm drawing their blank on their name at the moment, but they did an experiment on optics in which they proved that ether, well, what they said they proved is that ether didn't exist with their optics experiment, and they got a Nobel Prize for their optics experiment. But they actually, what they proved is that ether isn't in a stationary field, is what they proved.
Okay.
And that there was more going on there. And so, without looking into the details, it's quickly to just say, oh, well, it was proven long ago ether doesn't exist. When in fact, if you look more into the details, you realize actually that wasn't proved. And that's the reason why people later, after that effect, or after those experiments, people like Albert Einstein, Nikola Tesla, and others were still talking about ether, and they still believed in ether. Mm-hmm. And that it is a state of matter that things seem to come out of. Today, they just changed the name of it. Now they would call it the quantum field. And this is what the elements come out of. But the, you know, back then they didn't have words like quantum field. They just called it ether. So,
right.
You know, sometimes things, the names change, but what we're talking about is actually the same thing. And it's this ancient science. And I should also say that because the alchemists were concerned They believe that this energy that is at the basis of all material things was a conscious energy. There was consciousness behind it because it was, again, it was the mind stuff of the creator. This is where people later on as well, like Carl Jung, started studying alchemical texts because he believed like, oh, there must be some sort of collective consciousness that's tied into this, because he was seeing evidence of it in his own psychological studies. So as a result of that, there's this whole other new wing of alchemy that developed that was just psychological alchemy, you know, where it was all meant to be metaphors for our own consciousness awakening. And I would say that the ancient alchemists, and going back, you know, thousands of years, they would have said that, yes, the psychological aspect is an aspect of it too. But there is also actual chemical processes,
right,
and physical lab processes that can be done as well. And it's all, that's all of that is alchemy. And I will absolutely state 100% that there are things in the alchemical processes that are going to transform our world tremendously in the years ahead, that it's just now starting to get caught on and re-recognized by modern scientists, and some of this exotic states of matter that are found within alchemy are going to transform everything we're doing today and everything that we think we know about science and chemistry and how things go together, physics, quantum physics. There are exotic states of matter in alchemical processes that are going to transform everything. So that's just on the horizon.
I think it's already started because, what was it, probably now a year or two ago, scientists came out and they said, well, we believe now that there can be a heaven, but it's a quantum physics pocket.
Yeah, right. So, they changed the names of it. It's like, okay, right, sure, whatever.
As long as we can make it mechanical and we can make it work, right, in a truly physical form, we can, right, put it into our universe.
Right.
And to me, that's not us bending to them, or I shouldn't put it in an us and them. It's not the spiritual versus the physical. I'll put it that way. It's not the physical tugging back against the spiritual. It's the spiritual eventually getting to the physical.
Yeah, that's right.
It's the, you know, I really think that's what it is. I think it's the physical side going, you know what, we don't know how to say to you that we did find the spiritual side of the physical, and we can't deny it. It's there.
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, one of the, from a Templar perspective, you know, one of the symbols for the Templar order, in fact, the main symbol was the red Templar cross, which you see behind me, which is an equal armed cross. And really what that cross represented, amongst other things, was the vertical arm represented things spiritual. The horizontal arm represented things physical. And it was a symbol representing spiritualizing the material and materializing the spiritual. And of course, how do you do that? You have to do that through consciousness, through mind. Mm-hmm. And so mind stuff or consciousness is the foundation of all these sciences. So,
right. Absolutely. Yep. So we have now a way of figuring out how to break down chemically different things and using it to our advantage, alchemy.
Yeah.
Who figures this out? How is this done? Who plucks this out of the ether, so to speak? I'm going to use ether again.
Yeah.
Who gets this knowledge, or how is this knowledge presented to us?
Well, you know, the ancient alchemists would say that it's up to every person to find it for themselves. And they use there's an old term that I think Francis Bacon said that said that the glory of God is to hide a thing and the glory of man is to reveal it. Mm-hmm. And that's the process. But each person, it was hoped, alchemists hoped that if each person embarked on this path where they began to study matter, they began to study things like the liberal arts and sciences study the geometry behind how nature manifests itself, that you come to realize that, again, everything is connected to a mind. You know, it's all within a mind, and it would have to be that, because otherwise these patterns wouldn't be showing up the way they do.
Right.
It would be total chaos if there was no mind. Even chaos theory still is rested on the idea that there's an order behind what appears to be the disorder.
Yes.
I mean, that is the foundation of science, right? I mean, mm-hmm. You wouldn't have anything to study if there wasn't order behind nature. So,
right.
So it implied that there was a mind and intelligence behind creation. And through our own efforts, we can come to understand that. We can come to break nature down and then recombine it in new forms come to realize we can learn to make medicines with this. We can also learn to, it was believed you can definitely transmute metals, mm-hmm. if you needed to. And the purpose of that wasn't just to be like, get rich, like, oh, look at me, I turned lead into gold. It was more, how do we transform our environment so that we are in harmony with nature, but we're also, you know, taking care of ourselves.
Right.
And so that we can live peacefully without, without strife in this incredibly tumultuous environment or universe that we currently inhabit. And through that process, raise our consciousness in the process. To a point where ultimately the alchemists also talked that we could get to a state, and you find this within Hermetic and Neoplatonic and certain religious texts. It was believed we could get to a state where we could experience what was known as gnosis, which was a realized experiential knowledge of how the truth of how things really are. Mm-hmm. And it's the closest we can get while being incarnated to having an idea of the real consciousness of the creator. And by doing so, then we can become vessels healing and compassion and transformation in this world to help everybody attain that state eventually. I mean, it is similar to in the Eastern traditions, what we would refer to as enlightenment.
Yeah.
Same type of idea, only in the Western traditions is referred to as gnosis. Mm-hmm. And this was a part of that alchemical process as well. And it's for this reason that even many of the great alchemists of the, again, I'll say the 1500s through the 1800s, they adopted names that were the names of earlier Gnostic saints. Because Gnosticism was a competing religion at one point in time. It was framed within a Christian terminology. But it was deemed to be, in some ways, a competing religion to the standard Christianity, whatever flavor you want to say, you know, sure. Roman Catholicism, Eastern Orthodox, some of the Presbyterian and whatever, you know, whatever Lutheran, whatever you want to say, you know, modern forms of Christianity. Mm-hmm. The difference was to the Gnostics. And to the alchemists who were looking at this stuff, they believe that these myths associated with Christianity were about ourselves. They're about our own transformation and our own awakening. And that even though the central character may be Jesus, what it was really about was our own awakening to these higher states of consciousness, this gnosis. And that the alchemical process could help us to come to those realizations, not only from a, you know, the process of making this stuff, but actually ingesting the some of the things you make could also open your consciousness more to just different aspects of consciousness. And in fact, for this reason too, many of the alchemists were deemed to be drug manufacturers, messing around with psychedelic substances and mm-hmm. that type of thing. But they weren't just trying to be drug users. They were that was a step on the way to awakening. One would argue without the drugs, one would be able to come to these states internally. So. Yeah, it's a very interesting process.
And there's an interesting parallel that I've heard you talk about that I want to draw here a little bit later in the program. We're going to take a break here. That interesting parallel has to do with a Templar tradition in the Roman Catholic Church.
Yeah, sure.
And transmutation. You know where I'm going with it. We'll talk about it here in the second part of the program, which it blew my mind when you said it. I think it'll blow the listener's mind, too. We'll talk about it when we get back. Folks, we're just getting started here. We really are. It's going to be a very, very interesting program. We're talking about alchemy today, and we're talking with our guest, Timothy Hogan. And again, lots of different information here. You can go to Timothy Hogan's YouTube page and get some of this information as well. Lulu.com is his website. We'll have that link here in the description of this program. We'll have the YouTube link in the description of the program. The book, which we're talking about, is the Elements of the Elements, which we'll talk about the alchemic side of it. You also have a talk on your YouTube page, which is highly informative. It's about 35 minutes, which I watched earlier today, which was very, very interesting indeed. Timothy Hogan, our guest, will talk more about alchemy when we come back right here on The Best in Paranormal Programming. You're listening to Darkness Radio. Welcome back to The Best in Paranormal Programming. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Tim Dennis. Our guest is Timothy Hogan. And folks, we're just getting started. We're talking about alchemy. I forgot to mention before the break, you can check out Timothy Hogan live and in person in Las Vegas, November 10th through the 12th at Stairway to the Stars. You just go to disclosure.org for your tickets. And you'll be talking about alchemy there as well, won't you, Timothy?
I will, yeah. I'll be talking about alchemy in its different forms all over the ancient world and in showing how they all have a common source, that they had all inherited this science from an earlier pre-Diluvian civilization.
All right. Boy, that sounds interesting too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Man, see, I may have to get my ticket to Vegas just to go see that. You got me hooked in on that as well. Just to update you here, folks, Timothy, by the way, past master with several different spiritual and initiatic traditions. You're running the Templar Collegia. You're a current grandmaster for the Order of the Temple of Secret Initiates, Knights Templar lineage. You've got so many different. You've got at least 8 different books out there right now that people can pick up with lots of different knowledge out there. So again, a very esteemed guest. It's my honor to have you here today, Timothy. You. So I appreciate you being here. Okay, so getting into it here, we're talking about alchemy. we're talking about how we acquire this knowledge, how we get this knowledge, how they did at least in back in the, you know, in the, at least through the 1100s, 1500s, 1600s, and how it had to start. Now, you recently came back from Egypt.
Yeah.
And you talk about an ancient civilization that really used alchemy to form their great civilization.
Yeah,
an ancient civilization, the ancient Egyptians. Let's get into this for a minute. Okay. Ancient Egypt had to find a way to build these gigantic, not only pyramids, but ancient structures. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of people automatically say, well, I'm going to use a paraphrase here. It's aliens. Tell me why, Timothy, it's not aliens, and how exactly, or maybe not exactly, but what you hypothesize they used to get some of these structures put together, because some of these stones are tons, and they're cut so specifically. How do we achieve that on a human level when there couldn't have been workers that were that strong to put this all together?
Yeah, well, there, you know, again, a lot of it, I don't want to say all of it, but a lot of it does go back to alchemy. There was, in ancient Egypt, there was the myth of the god Osiris. This was the main myth, Osiris and Isis. They were a brother, sister, husband, wife team. Mm-hmm. Who ruled Egypt, it said. And you know, the stories about Osiris was he, and just like a real general, like, summary of the myth of Osiris is Osiris was, he was a vegetation god. He was painted green for that reason. He was his brother kind of tricked him. It said it was like a birthday party. He was given a coffin that he could that his brother Set had given him. This coffin, he got in the coffin, and he ended up then Set tricked him and cut him up into a bunch of pieces, threw him in the Nile River, and you know, it didn't look good for Osiris at that point.
Yeah.
So then what happened was he had a, sorry, I have a dog in the background.
No, that's fine. Like I told you pre-show.
He's barking.
Like I told you pre-show, we love dogs on this program. So yeah. we're more than fine with any dog in the background. So
very good. Well, so Osiris is thrown into the Nile. He's chopped up, thrown into the Nile. You'd think that was the end of it, but he actually, the pieces of him started washing up in different areas. Some say he had remained contained, and his coffin washed up and was absorbed by a particular plant that was known as the tamarisk. And out of this, the goddess Isis came and found him, got him reassembled back together. Well, she turned into herself into a bird and flew around him. And then she lit oil lamps and incense. And with the help of Sekhmet, who was the goddess, who is the goddess in charge of healing and also in charge of war, she ended up, Isis and Sekhmet were able to raise Osiris back to life. And so this was the first resurrection myth that pretty much all of the other in the eight of the world, you know, there's at least 16, some would say as many as 50 different characters through ancient mythology that were died and resurrected. But the Osiris was kind of the foundation of that. Okay. That Osiris was that foundation story. And most people just take it as that. They just say, oh, well, it's a, you know, it's just a mythological story. It's about how Osiris overcame death and became ruler of the underworld. And that's about as much as you need to look into it. But to the Gnostics, they saw this as a metaphor for how our world itself appears to be separated into lots of different pieces. And once we bring it all back into oneness and we see the bigger order of it all, that's where we attain gnosis. That's where we attain this divine knowledge. And they even looked at the stories of Jesus, which normally interpreted as resurrection is the Greek word anastasis. And anastasis actually in Greek just means awakening. Hmm. And so to the Gnostics, they said, well, this was the awakening to gnosis. It was the awakening to this divine knowledge. But applying the different stages of Osiris's story to alchemical processes, we have what are known as the three main processes that every alchemical transmutation must go through. The first is you start out with, again, a vegetation material of some kind, and whether it be an herb or a plant or a fungi or something that grows out of the earth,
okay,
including a metal. Metals would be included in this as well. Then you subject it to a solution, a liquid solution that'll break it down.
Okay.
Right. So you throw it into, in the story of Osiris, it was the Nile, right? It represented the water, this liquid component, right?
Right.
But so if you're talking about a metal, you're going to subject it to an acid. If you're talking about an herb, you may be subjecting it to an alcohol or even just water itself.
Mm-hmm.
What you do is you put it in this vessel and you'd allow it to digest at a slow heat, just like your food digests in your stomach.
Yep.
And it starts to break down through that digestion process.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts to break apart into the parts that made it up, basically. But it's in the solution.
Okay.
So this was the first stage. The next stage was you distilled that liquid. So, and by distilling it, you'd set up you might have a long neck vessel or put it in any number of different lab designed equipment designed to heat that liquid and turn it into a steam. And then that steam would fly up to the highest point of the vessel, and then it would condense and it would start to turn into a liquid again and flow into another vessel. And when you did that, you were separating the subtle aspects of what was in the original vessel and distilling it into another vessel. And this is where we get alcohol from, actually. This is, you know, the alcohol gets separated from the water. It ends up settling in this other new vessel. So in doing this process, in alchemical texts, this is always represented by birds.
Okay.
Right, because it's flying into it's turning into an air, it's turning into a steam,
right,
it's flying up to the top of the vessel. So this was represented by birds. And of course, in the story of Osiris, Isis turns herself into a bird.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and she's trying to reassemble the parts of him.
Yep.
So the first part is she turns herself into this bird and does these flies around the top of the area where he is, and she's trying to put his pieces back together in a new form.
Yeah.
So then the last stage then in the alchemical process is the remnant body that was at the bottom of the original flask had to be calcinated down to ashes. And out of those ashes, certain salts could be extracted. And those salts were fundamental to being recombined with the alcohol and the oils that were extracted from the distillation process in order to create a new form, a new body. And this new body would be, depending on what you started with, it could become a new medicine. It could become a new substance. And, but again, in the story of Osiris, right before Isis raises Osiris back to life, she's lighting the oil lamps and the incense. She's using fire, mm-hmm. right? To, mm-hmm. just like we do the calcinate down at the last stage. So these fundamental stages are included in the myth. People just aren't used to looking at it that way. But ultimately, if you do this experiment on a certain plants that grow in the Middle East, in Egypt, things like tamarisk, which is what Osiris was said to be buried in, you can extract some very special salts from it. Very, very special. Also, acacia is another one, one of the other plants that grow in the Middle East. And then there's another, a whole nother class of plants that are known as dictyopetalum, which was it's kind of a thorny type of plant. And what you can extract from that is actually hydrofluoric acid. And why that's significant is hydrofluoric acid can, in fact, melt granite.
Oh, wow.
Granite is full of silica. What it does is it melts the granite, starts to turn it into putty. So then you can shape stones, actually granite stones. You can cut the stones with it. You can shape it, and you can etch into the granite this way too. And the only thing that stops that hydrofluoric acid is beeswax and gold, ironically. So, if you were wanting to create an etch on a granite monument, all you would have to do is create a template using the beeswax and, you know, remove the beeswax from the areas where you wanted it to etch.
Yeah.
And then you just put one of these hydrofluoric acid washes on there and it would eat it away and create a nice perfect etching. So this was part of what the Egyptians were doing. And, you know, they had inherited and figured it out. And by the way, they also needed that hydrofluoric acid in order to break down other substances to extract the salts out of it. Wow. And they were specifically looking for the salts that they were extracting. We now refer to them today in our modern scientific language. We refer to them as monoatomic elements. What they are is they're platinum metals that have been reduced to what's known as a monoatomic state, where the outer valence ring is completely captured by the nucleus of the atom, and so it doesn't bind with anything. And when it does this, it takes on these really unusual properties. It enters the two outer electrons on the outer valence ring of the atom, enter into what's known as a Cooper pair.
Okay.
And they enter into a high speed state. So they don't, or high spin state. So they no longer bind with the other atoms. And when it does this, the first thing it does is it appears white because it's reflecting all the light, because it's all in this high spin state.
Mm-hmm.
But then the second thing it does is it enters into a superconductive state. And as it does this, amongst other things, I mean, it can be made into a medicine that you eat that like cures cancers, right? Because it's right now, most cancer is cured through things like chemotherapy, which is heavy metals.
Yes.
And the heavy metals, because it's in a heavy metal state, it's poisonous.
Yeah.
And it ends up curing the cancer, but it also makes people pretty sick in the process. Well, when it's in a high spin state, it's no longer in a heavy metal state. So it does the work of curing the cancer without those negative side effects. And this is something that the Mayo Clinic is actually looking into right now, developing further for cancer treatment.
Oh, wow.
But it was something that was done in the ancient world. And the other thing it does is when it's in this state, if you subject it to a weak electrostatic or electromagnetic fields, mm-hmm. it'll actually cause the container that's holding these monoatomic elements to weigh less. Like a container filled with the monoatomic elements and the same container filled with nothing, the container filled with the monoatomic elements will weigh less than the same container filled with nothing, because it causes an anti-gravity effect, causes a levitation effect on the container that's holding it. And so this is, you can start to see, okay, so through these processes, you can cut the granite. You can, in fact, if you go to the unfinished obelisk at Aswan, in Egypt, which is this giant thing, you know, they'll try to tell you this ridiculous story about how they use copper tools to carve it out, or other granite, you know, and they just banged away at it for a long time. And I mean, that would have been impossible, but there is evidence of this melting from the hydrofluoric acid that they would have been extracting to get that. And then once you got the salts, you could use the salts to, under the right conditions, to actually cause the granite to weigh less, start to weigh, to levitate somewhat, so you could easily move it. Wow. So this was all science of the that the ancient Egyptians inherited. And I do believe that. And the name for these secret salts, in ancient vernacular, was manna.
Okay.
This is the manna of the Bible. And this is the manna that was stored in the Ark of the Covenant. And this is the manna that was, that the wandering Hebrews ate.
Okay.
As they were wandering the desert. And this is why Moses witnessed God as a burning bush, because you have to calcinate down the vegetable matter in order to extract the manna from the salts or from the ashes. This is in the Abrahamic traditions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, you know, it's referred to as manna, but in other ancient cultures, it had the same name. I mean, in ancient Sumer, it was referred to as Shimana.
Okay.
And this was a substance that the gods used, the Anunnaki used, to create flying crafts. It was described that they created these flying crafts with this Shimana.
Okay.
In ancient India, it was referred to as Vimana. And it was described that they were doing the same thing there with creating these flying crafts with this substance. In the Buddhist traditions, it was referred to as mani or chintamani, which was, you know, like mana is just mani. So sure. Like if you ever see the Tibetan prayer of Om Mani Padme Hum, the mani is sometimes translated as precious jewel or precious stone. But it was this white stone, these white salts, you know, that could be extracted. Or in the Polynesian cultures, it was referred to as manna, you know. So it was right. So it's the same term being used in all these ancient cultures. It's just it was part of this alchemical process.
Why in God's name, Timothy, are we led to believe in the Roman Catholic Church, especially, that manna is...
It's the bread.
Yes! Why?
Yeah. Because they used to bake it into the bread and eat it. I mean, that was the shewbread that was found in the Old Testament or the Torah that the Hebrews were making. And so it was sometimes called as bread. And in fact, if we to the alchemists and to the Gnostics, they saw the story of Jesus, his birth, as entirely alchemical metaphor for alchemical processes. So, for example, one of the places that you can find manna in, you can find these monoatomic elements in abundance, is within sea salt. It's produced deep in the earth. It gets pushed up volcanically into the ocean, and it gets completely absorbed into salt, into the salt water. So there is a way of breaking down salt to extract it. And this is why the alchemists would say Jesus was born of Mary. Mary or Maria means sea or salt water. That's literally what Maria means. Mm-hmm. What happens when you heat salt water? Well, salt cubes crystallize out of it, right?
Yeah.
And if you take those, and I say cubes because they are, if you look at regular table salt under a microscope, it's little cubes.
Yeah.
Well, if you unfold a cube, you get a cross, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you're extracting the mana out of those salt cubes, you're symbolically opening up the salt cube, you know, to get the mana out of it. So here you have, you know, a cross symbol, which of course is associated with Christianity and Jesus. But not only that, but Jesus is said to then be born in Bethlehem. Well, Bethlehem in Hebrew means house of bread. So again, it's all a metaphor for extracting this salt or this secret salt, this mana, out of the normal salt, you know, out of the seawater or the Maria, Mary, the, you know, which literally means sea. So this is how they looked at it. And the rest of the story of Jesus throughout that myth reveals other aspects of that alchemical process. So, and this is why even in Revelations, it says, to he who overcometh will be given the hidden manna and the precious white stone, because it's alluding to this substance. And it was to the alchemists, they said, well, this was the science that Moses knew. He learned it from the Egyptian priests. This is why he burned the golden calf into a white powder. Everyone knows gold melts if you heat it, unless you do an alchemical process to it, at which point then you could extract out these platinum monoatomic elements. So it looks like a white powder.
Yeah.
And yes, you can eat it, and it makes the body more conductive. It heals the body of ailments. And yes, if you were to put it into a capacitor like a arc, which is basically what the arc is, it's an electrostatic capacitor it was built of alternating layers of acacia wood and gold. And if you put this mana inside of it, which is exactly what the Bible says was done, it would have built up, you know, out there in the desert. And especially when the ark was put in the tabernacle, which was basically a big tent with all these wool curtains, all it would do was just build up a tremendous amount of electricity, electrostatic potential, and it would discharge it through the top of the ark, and it could broadcast it. You know, this is one of the sciences of the ancient world. And this is the reason why nobody could touch the ark without being shocked to death. And I would argue it is also the reason why the Levites were in charge of protecting the ark, because when you put those monoatomic elements in something like the ark would have weighed, you know, probably a ton, mm-hmm. right, from all the gold that was in it. But yet two people were able to carry it with rods. Why is that? You know, with these rods, they're able to carry it no problem. Well, it's because of how the monoatomics were behaving when they would be hit with that electric potential. It would cause the container holding them to start to lose weight. And again, the people in charge of the ark were the Levites, and this is really where we get the term Levitation from, because that's how the ark would literally levitate to carry it, you know, when it was being activated. So yeah, it's all cool stuff. But we think of one Ark of the Covenant, from the Bible.
Yes.
But in ancient Egypt, they have depictions of arcs at every temple in Egypt. And they have depictions on the temple walls of arcs undergoing different transportation places. And they also show these cakes, these bread cakes, these manna cakes, and that are referred to as white gold in the hieroglyphs. And they show them as being associated with these arcs. And I'm quite certain that it was an ancient technology that the Egyptians had for a while. And they tried to preserve the knowledge of it as best they could. In time, I think a lot of the arcs got caught. Several of them probably got melted down for the precious metals. And now we just have this kind of legend of it, but it's still depicted all over the temple walls. Pretty much every temple you go to in ancient Egypt has these arcs depicted.
So am I to understand then, Timothy, that the ark is like a giant battery?
It is. It's a giant capacitor.
Okay.
And it would build up immense amount of charge and hold it, and then it would just discharge it through the wings. And honestly, if you were to put one of those arcs in the Great Pyramid, for example, which is a giant structure that has its own electrostatic potential and electromagnetic qualities, which are being studied right now. If you were to put one of those arcs with the mana in it inside the Great Pyramid in the King's Chamber, for example, it would probably broadcast electricity through the region wirelessly, much like Nikola Tesla was trying to do with his Wardenclyffe Tower.
Well, it almost sounds to me, and forgive me for being a little forward with this, when you were talking to Jimmy Church on Fade to Black, and I don't normally promote other shows, but I'm promoting this one because I want people to check this out.
Yeah.
When you were in Egypt, and I don't remember which pyramid you were in, you were talking about seven gates, and you were talking about was it Saba that it had on the outside of it?
Saba means Stargate.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if you put an arc in there with some mana and you had this electrical charge, to me, that sounds like a battery or a capacitor to open a Stargate. Does it not?
Yeah, potentially. Yeah. I mean, one of the other things you find around Egypt is you find stones with what are known as butterfly clamps between them.
Okay.
They were like these clamps, and you find this in the Americas as well, in places like Cusco and some of the ancient Central American megalithic sites.
Mm-hmm.
But you have these, they're called butterfly clamps because they kind of look like a butterfly shape, and they hold two stones together. Well, if you go to many of the temples of Egypt, places like Kom Ombo and places at Elephantine Island and Abydos and all kinds of other places, you find these stones lining the ground. They're not like up high or anything. They're on the ground. And you can see where the butterfly clamp was. And there used to be metal in those butterfly clamps. I mean, over time, all the metal was removed and was probably melted down, for whatever. But I think probably what those were originally, they used to have them all lined up, lining the perimeter of these temples. And I think what those were is they were kind of like the receiver for this energy that was being broadcast. So you could literally plug things into those stones, or those butterfly clamps and, to power whatever, I think at one point in time. And, we've kind of lost the technology, but that seems to be what was going on there. And yeah. And a number of these sites do refer to stargates.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, but they also refer to, if you look at the base of the pillars of pretty much all of the ancient temples, whether you're talking about Abydos or Dendera or Edfu or Esna or any of these places, at the base of the pillar, there's a hieroglyph that basically means received from the stars is what it means.
Okay.
So it's implying that the knowledge for how to even build this temple came from the stars. And then in the sanctums of these temples, most of them, there's a hieroglyph for Saba, which just means stargate. And yeah, they have these depictions of these gates. And in some instances, in some of the places, they actually depict the gods, the Nidiru, coming out of what looks like a stargate, like the movie Stargate. I mean, it's literally like an oval with a bunch of stars in it, coming out of the stargate and then teaching the pharaoh, whoever it is, who's associated with that temple,
right?
Usually, how to do certain things. And, you know, if you're looking at that with our modern understanding of a number of things, it's pretty interesting. And
right
now we can argue who those gods are, who those meter are, if they're extraterrestrials, if they were, you know, beings that were coming through, like Star Trek being beamed in there or what, you know what I mean? If it was a time travelers, it's another theory.
True.
But it's very clear that they believed, the Egyptians believed, that they were aligning these temples towards certain star systems, and that there was knowledge coming through these stargates to the leadership, and they were using a technology to do all this. And, it's my belief that, well, you know, this was an ancient technology that probably existed pre-cataclysm, and in what we would might call Atlantis or something like that. And when civilization collapsed during the Younger Dryas period, all of that was lost until there were certain later Egyptians that started finding it again.
Yeah.
And then they started rebuilding civilization. And in fact, that seems to be what was really going on in Egypt, is these pharaohs were trying to preserve high technology that they were finding that they didn't entirely understand. Somewhere along the line, they figured out how to harness some of it. And then it became this closely guarded secret amongst the pharaoh and probably his top priest. So
wouldn't it be something if that stargate now a lot of people again like to scream aliens, but wouldn't it be something if that stargate was simply just time travel?
Could be, yeah.
And they got to the end of time and
I mean, it could be like in another 100 years or few hundred years, we could maybe we develop the technology to try time travel back.
And yeah.
And so what they were witnessing was us, you know, I mean, going back. And
they got a hold of some Gnostics or some Templar that said, you know what, we'll help you. And here's exactly how you're supposed to advance your civilization.
Right. Well, and this is, you know, going back to the Templar thing, I mean, the Templars who all came out of Gnostic families. And these Gnostic families say they all came from Egypt originally. They were just passing on a tradition. So these Templars, their entire purpose for being set up, the common narrative was that they were set up to protect pilgrims in the Holy Land. And that was really just kind of a cover for them. What they were really doing was they were set up to seek it. They believed the story of Noah.
Okay.
They noticed that there were too many other cultures that had these flood myths, and so that there had to be something to it.
Mm-hmm.
So they said, well, if there was a flood, that means prior to the flood, there was a high civilization. And clearly they were more advanced because the people were living a lot longer, mm-hmm. if we want to believe the Bible story. So they wanted to seek out and find the remnants of that pre-civilization so that they could utilize that knowledge and that technology to uplift Europe. And that was their whole reason for originally being created. And when they couldn't when they couldn't implement that in Europe, that's when they went to the New World, into the Americas, to try to see where they could implement this stuff.
Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting stuff indeed. Now, there's one other offshoot, if you may call it that, of mana that I wanted to talk about. And it's an interesting, because again, I was raised Roman Catholic. I was an altar boy for 4 years.
Sure.
And this absolutely grabbed me by the ears, and I shook my head and I went, oh, of course, this makes absolute sense. Transmutation.
Yeah.
So in the Catholic Church, they believe when you receive wine and bread that it is transmutated into the body and the blood of Christ when you consume it.
Right.
And I'm sitting there and I'm watching you, Timothy, on YouTube, and you explain how when mana is consumed, and there's a ritual that among Templar, and I'll let you take over from here because I don't want to mess your words up here. But there's a Templar ritual, and it completely describes where it must have been Constantine or somebody grabbed it and brought this Gnostic ritual over and kind of stole it for their own and went, hey, we like that. You know, we like that. We like that ritual. We're going to take it and we're going to make it for our own. Explain to our listening audience where this ritual got co-opted and made into a Catholic ritual, and then eventually a Christian ritual.
Well, it was. I mean, originally the ritual goes back to ancient Egypt, actually, where they talked about the body and the blood of Osiris. And they used to actually do this communion rite, but I think it was with these alchemical elements, because you can take the mana, the white mana, and you can do this other process to it where it transmutes into a red liquid. And that red liquid looks and tastes like blood. It's not blood.
Right.
There's no blood in it whatsoever, but it's just part of the process of transmuting it. And so here you had your body and your blood of Osiris in the ancient world, you know, from these alchemical processes. And that then started to get passed down and adopted into Mithraism, into Christianity, into, you know, other mysteries. But the, and then of course, Melchizedek was also associated with doing in the Old Testament, or the Torah was he initiated Abram, he performed a communion with bread and wine, after which Abram changed his name to Abraham, because that was his new esoteric name. And of course, you know, Islam, Christianity, and Judaism all come out of, they're the Abrahamic faiths because of that reason. They all come out of Abraham. But the the Templars, once they figured out, based on their own Gnostic lineage that they had grown up in, you know, some of the founding Templars, but then also their study of meeting with other groups in the Middle East that were translating Greek and Roman texts on alchemy. There were certain Islamic and Druze and Sabaean factions that were translating these texts, and they were meeting with the Templars, and they started figuring out, and then also the stuff that they were looking at in Egypt, they figured out how to reproduce this process, you know, and the alchemical way, the actual alchemical way. And so they set up a their own communion rite, which they referred to as the sharing of the salt ceremony.
Okay.
That was their communion rite. They had also the Manichaean tradition that they, some of them had come out of, had another ceremony called the Mani Sola ceremony, mm-hmm. which was the same thing as this communion rite with these alchemical substances. And this was the origin of the communion rite that Christianity does now, but Christianity just uses bread or wafers and wine to represent these substances. And further, I guess, proof of this, if you wanted to look at it from a Roman Catholic standpoint, is when you transmute these substances, they all go through the same color changes. They turn black, and then they turn red, and then they turn white. Hmm. For example, when you're going to extract the mana out of the ashes, first you calcinate down the plant, mm-hmm. and you're going to get charcoal, which is black. Then with further heat and some water, it starts to turn the charcoal into a reddish ash. Mm-hmm. And then you could subject that ash to certain acids and alkalis and extract the white mana out of it. Mm-hmm. Right? So it goes black, red, white. And all the alchemical processes go through those color changes. And this is really the reason why the Templars had a black and white flag with a red cross in the center of it. And it's also the reason why in the Roman Catholic Church, what color did the priests wear? Black.
Black. Yes.
What color do the cardinals wear?
Red.
Red. What color does the Pope wear?
White.
White. Right. That's the hierarchy. It's going through the same color transmutation process.
Yeah.
And I do not believe that was coincidence.
No, it's not a mistake. No,
I mean, the Roman Church had its own alchemists, people like Roger Bacon and others, and who were looking into this stuff as it was being brought back by the Templars. So,
interesting. Yep. Interesting indeed. It's yeah. We recently had, you know, we had the how should I put this? What a lot of people will look at as a scary day, Friday the 13th, October 13th. Yeah. Some people think it's a day of horror movies. Some people think it's a day of biblical proportions of the Last Supper. Other people recognize it as the day of Templar calling. How do you observe Friday the 13th?
Yeah. So, well, as a Templar, you know, the history of the Knights Templar were, so very early on, the Templar Order, according to our tradition, was actually founded long before when most historians say it was founded. Mm-hmm. But by 1118, the Templar Order was looking into, they had already settled themselves in Jerusalem, and they were looking at patronage to accomplish the things that they were going to do. They knew they had to go down there and find certain artifacts. They even had knowledge of where to look for some of this stuff. But they needed patronage to fund them to do it. So one of the Templar members, one of the founding members who later became one of the Grand Masters, he was the nephew of St. Bernard of Clairvaux, who was a very prominent church father who actually ended up writing the rule for the Templars because of those connections. And he was able to set the Templar Order up as kind of like a wing of the Cistercians.
Okay.
And the idea was that the Templars would go out, find stuff, bring it back for the Cistercians to translate, and this would be to the glory of the church. Mm-hmm. And so the Templars were like, look, you fund us, you know, be our patron. We will help you out. We'll get you things, and we'll bring back some of this knowledge for you. So they agreed to it. and so they started funding the Templars, and it got to the point where people started donating. They would want to join the Templars, so they would donate all their wealth and everything to the Templar order, and just, you know, walk away from, you know, their old life and become a Templar, give the Templars all their stuff, and then they would participate in this work of like becoming a warrior monk, doing this stuff. And but a lot of that wealth, then it really, the Templar order, they didn't have to answer to anybody but the Pope, right, because of the mission that they were doing. And as a result, they just gained a whole lot of money. They began to set up a banking system. In fact, checks today come from the Templar process of this banking system that they set up. And it was so people could travel from one part of Europe to another, or from one part of Europe to the Holy Land. They could deposit their money in Europe, and then when they got to the Holy Land, they could offer a proof and therefore be able to then retrieve their money to use in the Holy Land. So, you know, the Templars became very wealthy through all this process. Not to mention that, you know, they were also discovering all kinds of treasures, gold artifacts, silver artifacts, precious, all kinds of precious stuff, manuscripts, the whole bit. And as a result, they were super wealthy. And by the time of 1307, the King of France, who was Philip the Fair, he owed the Templar order a lot of money because he had borrowed all kinds of money from them in order to fund his war efforts. And he really didn't want to pay it back. And even beyond that, he wanted to make himself up as the new war king to start some new wars in Europe. And it takes a lot of money to do that. So he devised a plan. By September of 1307, he issued arrest orders for all the Templars in Europe to take place in a month in October. And he hoped to do this as a surprise, to surprise the Templar order, arrest everybody, accuse them of heresy on false charges so that he could seize their assets. And he entered into a little bit of a conspicuous groups other than Catholicism. The Roman Church, Europe, but the Templars, here were the Templars who answered to no one but the Pope, but they were going around, and the Templars were associating with Muslims, with Jews. They're protecting Muslim and Jewish right to worship. They had close associations with the Druze and the Sabaeans, the Coptic Church, the Eastern Church. They were associated with everybody, and this made the Roman Church very uncomfortable. So they tried to get the Templar Order to merge with the Knights Hospitallier, later known as the Knights of Malta, but the Grand Master of the Templars, Jacques de Molay, didn't want to do that. Mm-hmm. And so the church went along with Philip the Fair, the King of France, doing this brutal suppression on Friday, October 13th, 1307, rounding up all the Templars they could in France and the rest of Europe, torturing them for 7 years, getting them to give false confessions to all kinds of stuff, you know, which they did under torture. And then ultimately they ended up burning Jacques de Molay, the Grand Master of the order, at the stake, along with a number of other Templars. And for most historians, certainly historians that were funded by the Roman Church, this they said was the end of the Templar order, right? Because at this point, the Roman Church was no longer giving them patronage. So, and they had been dissolved, essentially. Their properties were given to the Knights Hospitaliers, later to become the Knights of Malta. Mm-hmm. And so it was deemed, well, that was the end of the Templar order. To Templars, though, modern day Templars of different lineages, you know, they'll say, well, no, actually, that's just when the order went underground. They went to places like the New World, and they started to work to try to set up a new Templar state, which they tried to do that in Portugal for a while. They tried to do that in France until they were suppressed. In the creation of States of America is really the culmination of some of those efforts after they had been suppressed.
It's interesting when, as you go to give that information, we start to break up a little bit. It's I don't know why that is, but it's weird. But we get the gist of what you said there. Yeah. When I look at it as coming from Templar blood, I'm saddened when I see Friday the 13th, and a lot of people, a lot of people assume now that we had the horror movies and stuff like that, they've moved off that the remembrance of the atrocities against Templar. But for the longest time, I guess when I was before the horror movies, when I was real young, it was remembered as that Templar Atrocity Day, and I didn't, you know, it was an odd thing to remember, and not a good thing to remember, until you start to learn about, I don't want to call it alternate history, because you know it's not. When you get older and you start to see that this great organization has continued, and it never did go away.
Right.
Then you can go, oh, you know what? It never did go away, you know, and you can, right. you can just say, oh, you know what? It did thrive.
It was just a dark time for a period right after the suppression.
And so you just kind of take a breath and go, oh, okay, well, if that's the way the world really wants to remember it, then fine and dandy. If that's what keeps the name out there, sure.
Right.
But it's, I wanted to ask that question because I wonder, you know, as someone who is high in the organization, how do you look at that day, especially when the mainstream media goes, well, it's Friday the 13th. And then they automatically put that Templar name out as being part of the legend and lore of it.
Yeah. I mean, we usually tend to, as Templars, we celebrate it more as, so according to our tradition, again, Philip the Fair, the King of France, he issued those arrest orders almost a month before they were actually carried out. And during that time, our order figured out what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. And so there was a plan on behalf of the order where most of the members of the order in France were responsible for smuggling out all of the riches, the manuscripts, the sacred treasures. They got it all smuggled out before Friday, October 13th. But in order to do this, there was a certain number of Templars that had to kind of stay behind and pretend like things were business as usual, including Jacques de Molay, the Grand Master, in order to make it seem like they didn't know what was coming. And of course, Jacques de Molay thought, okay, well, we'll get arrested and I'll be able to talk us out of this. You know, I don't think he thought it would have been as brutal as it turned out being, but what ended up happening was they did get arrested and they did get tortured. And even though the majority of the Templars had already taken off the treasure, in fact, and all the boats and everything else had hoped to capture. And all the Roman church had left over was these buildings that the Templars had built and the remnants of the cathedrals that the Templars had helped to build. But so we tend to look at the date as the day of the Templar martyrs.
Okay.
Because these people had to have extreme courage to stay behind, knowing that they're going to be rounded up and potentially tortured. And they were doing this to ensure that the sacred manuscripts and other treasures would be safely snuck out of France and other areas to ensure they didn't fall into bad hands.
Okay.
And that was really, so even though it was a tough time, Friday, October 13th, we do that. We always light a candle in memory of those Templar martyrs. And by the way, there's also a number of Gnostic churches that still continue to exist to this day, including the Ecclesia Gnostica of California, the Gnostic Sanctuary in California, the Ecclesia Gnostica of Texas down in Austin, the Apostolic Joannite Church, which is a Gnostic lineage, and they have churches all over the world. And they always, on the Sunday closest to Friday, October 13th, they do a special service where they celebrate the Templar martyrs, and they remember them, and they do a ceremony in the church, you know, which, and it's because of that close relationship that existed between the Templar order and the Gnostic tradition in times past.
Good.
And still continues to exist to this day.
Okay. Well, good. That's good to know. That's good to know.
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Hogan, it's been such a pleasure to sit down and talk with you. I hope we can do this again.
Yeah. Well, I would love to do it. Anytime you want to do it, let me know. We can do another program. There's a lot we can still talk about.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'd love to sit down and talk with you more about, there's so many different topics we can sit down and talk about. In the meantime, we do need to tell people, disclosurefest.org. You're going to be in Las Vegas, Stairway to the Stars. Tickets are available right now. That is November 10th through the 12th. I know you are on Friday. Friday afternoon, you'll be talking about alchemy there. The exact topic again is?
Well, it's alchemy in the ancient world. Ultimately, it's about how all of these ancient civilizations were practicing the same ancient science, which they inherited from somebody else.
Wow.
So that's what, you know, whether it was time travelers or extraterrestrials or just the Atlanteans. I mean, I believe it was an ancient science of Atlantis.
Okay.
Plato seemed to allude that in his writings, and it was inherited by these other traditions after the collapse of that cataclysm. So that's what I'll be looking at. I'll be showing the proof of that.
I got to figure out a way to get to Vegas. That's all I know. And if you want to read more into this, The Elements of the Elements is available. We'll have a link to the book in the description of the show, so you can check that out as well. There are 8 great books out there. We'll have a link to, I take it you have an author page on Amazon?
Yeah. Timothy Hogan author page. Yeah.
Yep. We'll link to the author page on Amazon, so you can check that out. Lulu.com is the actual publisher website. So we'll link you to there as well. So you can check out the author, publisher page that Timothy Hogan has. And we'll link you to the YouTube page, because there's some great talks as well that Timothy Hogan does as well. So we want you to check out the information there. Mr. Hogan, sir, thank you so much for being on the program today.
Thank you so much. So great chatting with you. I'm glad we were able to do this.
Well, thank you, sir. I want to thank Timothy Hogan for being on the show today. Again, it was all my pleasure to have him on the show today. It's a guest I've been wanting to have on for quite some time and talk to him about some of the different things that he talks to different people about all year round, and bring some of that knowledge to the program, because really, folks, sometimes we have to stretch beyond our knowledge base and learn about other things. And this may be one of those programs that to you is maybe a little controversial. And maybe it's one of those programs that you may scratch your head and go, huh, never thought of it that way before. But one of those guests that definitely stretches you outside your boundaries and gets you to think about other things. Again, Timothy Hogan has some books out there that you can read. We have a link to that in the description of this program. He's going to be at Stairway to the Stars in Las Vegas. We'll have a link to that as well in the description of this program. All his links in the description of this program. I encourage you to learn more about Timothy Hogan and find out more. Speaking of, as we get ready to wrap up and head for the weekend here, I generally tell you to take care of yourself and each other as we get ready to go to our weekend. I'm going to tell you to, this weekend, be a shining light into someone's darkness. I went to Timothy Hogan's Facebook page as we were prepping for this interview, and I saw one of his posts, and he was talking about having a responsibility to show people a better way to be, even if they treat you badly, which is interesting because we really do treat each other badly in society today. And especially today, you look around, there's a lot of dark points in society. It's just the way things are. And one of the interesting things at the end of this post, it's a longer post, especially for Facebook, but it's interesting. At the end, he says, it doesn't matter how people treat you. What matters is how you treat people. Your actions are the only thing that you have control over. Make sure they are done with kindness and consideration, regardless of how others may act towards you. Only then can you be an example of a greater way to operate in this world. It's an excellent post. He quotes Lao Tzu in it. He says, what is a good person but a bad person's teacher? What is a bad person but a good person's job? Think about that for a second. A little something to think about going into the weekend. So this weekend, from me to you, be a shining light in someone's darkness. Think about it for a second. It's not just a poetic way to close the show. It really is a way to think about your impact on humanity. Instead of being negative and taking the negative path towards life and thinking, I'll never do this, I'll never do that, don't put the negativity out there. Put the positivity out there and see how it changes your life. Always put the positive foot forward and watch the positive come back to you. And start with other people. You don't have to start with yourself. Start with the people who come into your life, willingly or unwillingly. Treat others the way you'd want to treat yourself. And watch it come back tenfold. You'd be surprised. Try it this weekend. I want to thank you guys. And I do this quite often, but there's a reason I do it. It's an attitude of gratitude. I really am grateful for each and every one of you that listen to this program, that give me feedback. Even those of you who listen to this program and I may never hear from you. I'm truly grateful for the fact that you download this program and you listen to it. That you listen to this voice of mine and listen to others' voices that come across this program and talk to you and give you the information that they have to share. I hope you're enjoying this journey that you take along with myself and Bruiser and Mally and Jess. Because I enjoy the time that we spend together. And I love that you've taken that time, your short time here on this earth, and some of that time you've chosen to spend it with us. That means more than you will ever know to all of us. So again, I want to thank you from the bottom of our hearts for taking that time with us. It means so much. We've got some great shows on the way for you folks at the end of October here coming into November. And we can't wait. We can't wait to show you what we've got in store for you. So thank you so much for being a part of our family. We love being a part of yours. And thank you so much for tuning in to the best in paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio.